Americans hate rats. But is that hatred really deserved?
The canon of rat horror knows no bounds, really. And as someone who's interested in nature and loves nature, I wanted to interrogate that in myself, but also in among wider society as well, to sort of drill down into that notion of what is it about rats which we deem so unacceptable.
That's Joe Shute. We talk with him about his book, Stowaway, The Disreputable Exploits of the Rat. Then, looking at animals as our neighbors, with thoughts and feelings not so far from our own.
One of the arguments that I make in the book is that, you know, when it comes to relating to nature and sort of thinking about the wild world, all these ways that we have of seeing nature, you know, as a source of beauty or transcendence or natural resources, looking at it through the frames of conservation biology, thinking about biodiversity, you know, all of these lenses for looking at nature really don't include a sense of wild animals, or of animals, broadly speaking, don't include a sense of animals as being intelligent, as possessing minds, much like we do.
That's Brandon Kime. He tells us about his book, Meet the Neighbors, Animal Minds and Life in a More Than Human World. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Mayor Adams of New York City has declared war on them. They've been blamed, possibly unfairly, for spreading such epidemics as the Black Death. George Orwell featured them as an instrument of ultimate torture in 1984. I'm talking, of course, of rats. Yet, as my guest Joe Shute has discovered, they are as sweet and affectionate as dogs and cats when kept as pets. And rats share a lot of positive features with us humans, including empathy, cooperation, and adaptability. They even like dancing to music. And some rats are helping war zones get free of landmines and helping doctors diagnose illness. Yes, rats can be problematic, but perhaps we should respect them, even love them, more than we do. In his book, Stowaway, Shute illuminates the surprising emotional and intellectual capabilities of rats. And he joins us now. Joe Shute, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me on.
So, Stowaway, The Disreputable Exploits of the Rat. They're not all disreputable, by the way. There's some quite reputable exploits. I love this book. I have to say right off the bat that I was always grossed out by rats, just like you were at one time, until somebody gave me a rat to take care of in the last few weeks of its life, actually. They were unable to take care of it. And I totally fell in love with this affectionate, sweet, long-suffering, but very loving creature. And so when I saw your book, I thought, that's great. Finally, a book about rats that will really talk about them in a balanced way. Why did you want to write a book about rats?
Well, it's lovely to hear that personal connection. And also coming from a basis of being grossed out by rats as well. It was the same for me. And that was really the basis for me in wanting to write this book. I'm a writer of nature and write for British newspapers about nature and the environment. I've written previous books about different aspects of the natural world. But what really interests me as a writer are the certain species, and they tend to be scavengers, but certain species that humans project a lot of baggage onto. We create a reputation for these animals. And the rat is an animal that humans have projected more onto than any other creature. And I feel, you know, I felt exactly the same about that. When I was growing up, I was kind of taught to be grossed out, to sort of to almost hate rats. And that was something I took with me into adulthood. And, you know, I always had a kind of irrational fear of rats, would be really creeped out by the idea of encountering one on the streets, would, you know, all the things we associate with them, of them being dirty animals, of them being disease-ridden animals, of them being animals that even ridiculously might attack us, you know, kind of in packs or whatever. I mean, the canon of rat horror knows no bounds, really. And as someone who's interested in nature and loves nature, I wanted to interrogate that in myself, but also in among wider society as well, to sort of drill down into that notion of what is it about rats which we deem so unacceptable, particularly when they're an animal that lives so close to us as well. You know, they are a sort of shadow species to humans. They've followed us around the world as humans have shifted. They've gone everywhere humans have. They exist on every continent in the world, apart from Antarctica. And they follow human migration patterns from east to west as well. I guess initially I wanted to discover the history of the rat, but in doing so, I feel like this book also kind of opened up an aspect of human history to me that perhaps didn't imagine it might do when I first started. But really, I wanted to see the rat on its own terms and to set aside that baggage that humanity has projected on it and see actually what a rat is, how it lives, where it lives, what its motivations are. And it was a constant surprise for me in terms of, you mentioned it yourself, your last few weeks with that dying rat. And I saw it both in the animals I studied out in the wild, but also I thought over the beginning of this book, I need to get pet rats as well. So I took in, me and my wife, we took in two pet rats during the first COVID pandemic, during the first lockdown, and I've had them as pets ever since. And they've opened up a remarkable world of rats to me that I had no idea existed.
And it's such a wonderful tale. We'll go more deeply into it. But first, you mentioned that rats are a shadow of us. You know, you said they've followed us everywhere, so you could say they've shadowed us everywhere. But you really mean more than that when you talk about rats as a shadow.
First, on the basic geographical level, they're a species that in the Western world aren't native here. There's a whole host of more than 60 species of rats, but the two main ones in which my book focuses on are the brown rat and the black rat. They are the rats that your listeners will see kind of milling about the neighborhoods around them. Brown rats, particularly in the US, same as the UK. Elsewhere in Europe, it's black rats that are more populous. Both of those species aren't from here. Black rats originate from India and brown rats originate from China. And they shifted across on the ancient trade routes that opened up corridors from east to west. So kind of geographically speaking, they have shadowed humans, but they have possessed a lot of human characteristics and qualities. And I think that's maybe what you're getting at with that question. And there have been all number of scientific studies that have borne this out, of the very human characteristics that rats are capable of showing. And I've seen this myself in my own pet rats as well. So empathy, for example, there's a whole host of studies that show rats possess incredible empathy for other rats within their colonies, and they will often sacrifice themselves to assist an ailing rat, just as we like to think that we would do if we were put in the same situation with a stranger or otherwise that we know. Rats possess the power of imagination. Neuroscientists have shown that rats dream when they're asleep, through incredibly complicated processes of kind of wiring up a rat's brain and watching the different parts of where it flickers. Rats possess an innate sense of enjoyment and a love of touch. Numerous study I mentioned, I got my pet rats in lockdown at a time when, you know, all of us were deprived of touch and the human contact that we were used to. And I was reading studies about scientists who stroked rats for a couple of minutes a day and recorded their hypersonic giggles that are completely inaudible to the human ear. And again, I've seen this with my rats. They love being stroked and tickled in the way that a pet puppy would, or a cat. And perhaps my favorite shadow characteristic of rats is that they're the only other species aside from humans which have been shown to enjoy dancing to music. And there's a fascinating study which played different songs to them, ranging from Mozart to Lady Gaga. And it showed rats swaying to the beat of the music, and it played the music at different tempos as well, and found that the tempo which the rats would react to the most and would sway to the most is exactly the same tempo that humans enjoy the most as well. Off the top of my head, it's 180 beats per minute, but that might be wrong. It's somewhere in the book. And they're the only other animal that's been shown to do that aside from us. And they also, you know, they're all positive characteristics, which I've mentioned, but there are many kind of negative characteristics which really sort of preoccupy our thinking around rats. Their aggression, their ferocity when challenged, their industriousness, you know, their ability to eke out a home wherever it is and eke out a life for themselves. And I would argue they're very human qualities as well, and they're the reason why humans have dominated the planet so successfully, and why rats, you know, are so successful in our wake as well.
And they also flourish, especially, you say, in the spaces that we've opened up through war and trauma.
Yeah, as a kind of UK school kid, I've always been fascinated by history, and the books I write, they're natural histories, but they're cultural histories and they're social histories as well. I'm interested in that kind of intermingling space where the three of those things overlap. When I was at school, we learned about rats in the trenches of the Western Front in the First World War that would grow to humongous proportions on feasting on the dead bodies in no man's land, and that would steal soldiers' rations. And there's incredible, I've researched this a bit for the book, reading some of the accounts of First World War soldiers describing the rats that were there. And as a source of sort of disgust, but also a source of fun as well. And they would have days where they'd go out rat hunting. And you can find the photos online of French, German, English soldiers who have kind of strung up the sort of spoils from a day's rat hunting. We're seeing it now in the trenches along front between Ukraine and Russia as well, where rat populations are exploding, mice as well, and there's particularly rodent-borne diseases which are feared to be on the increase as a result. And we see it more broadly moving away from conflict areas in areas of environmental degradation as well. And rats thrive on agricultural monocultures, so areas where a natural landscape has been changed, obviously, by human agricultural activity to grow food, but where once would have been an area with pockets of different trees, for example, or different wildflowers, it's simply a monoculture of a crop. And when you get to those locations, that's where rats thrive as well. And you see that these huge increases of rats on farms and in farmland as part of the book. And it's an international book, and I visited areas all over the world to see how people interacted with rats. And one of those places was Tanzania, where there's a chapter which talks about the best of rats and the worst of rats. And I hope we can talk in a bit more depth about the best of rats. I won't go into that now. But in terms of the worst of rats, I visited a series of villages that were strung along a sugarcane plantation that had been planted in place of which was once pristine forest. And it was, as far as the eye could see, just a kind of wall of sugarcane. And obviously the rats' natural predators would have been wiped out through that. The rodents themselves had just descended on what was this perfect landscape for them and were really making the lives of the agricultural labourers who lived in villages along those fields a total misery, tunnelling into their houses, biting them at night, biting their children at night, stealing their food and spreading all kinds of diseases. But the reason the rats were there in such numbers was because of human activity, and we created this very unnatural environment where rats thrive.
Yeah, well, let's talk about Tanzania. You've just talked about the negative aspect, and it was hard to read about, because in the book, in Stowaway Joe Shute, you talk about the positive use of rats in Tanzania first. You know, so the heart is so warmed, and I'm going to ask you about them in a minute. But then to read about this place where the aim is to exterminate them because they are such a danger, just really hurt. So first, let's go back and talk about the Apopo Project, I believe it is. And also tell us about the Rat Magawa.
So Apopo is a project based at a university in Tanzania, which has been going for more than 20 years now. And I'd heard about it before. And I didn't believe it when I first heard about it, because the project is based around training up rats as landmine detectors. And it was the brainchild of a couple of Belgian university researchers. And it basically is harnessing the incredible power of smell that rats possess and using that, exploiting that for human good. They have a very intense training program where rats are put through their paces on a minefield, which is based within the university. And these rats are then, once they're deemed of sufficient experience, they're sent to conflict zones all over the world. And their legacy is extraordinary. They've cleared in the region of 160,000 landmines since the project started, in countries from Angola, Mozambique, Laos, Cambodia, areas where, you know, there's a huge legacy of landmines going back generations. And there are certain species of rat that they use for it, which are called giant African pouch rats. And the reason they use those is they're slightly bigger than your average brown rat that you'd see on a New York subway or a city street somewhere else, but otherwise more or less the same. And these rats are more long-lived, so they live for about 7 years, while your average brown rat will live for about 2 to 3 years max. So they get a lot of kind of bang for their buck in terms of how many landmines they can clear, or not bangs, I should say. When I got to the Sokoine University in a city called Morogoro, where the project is based, and when I got there, I booked the trips months ago, but when I arrived there, Apopo was in the news because their main rat, their number one rat, who was called Magawa, had just died of natural causes after a very long and storied career where he personally had cleared whole football fields worth of landmines. He was the recipient of something called the PDSA Medal, which is a sort of peace medal, which is given to, it was launched in the Second World War, initially for passenger pigeons and homing pigeons that would share messages. The Allies particularly used them to share messages during the Second World War. But since then, it had been applied to a whole host of different animals, you know, horses, rescue dogs, that kind of thing. There'd never been one given to a rat before, but Magawa was the first one for his exemplary work in the field of landmine clearance. And he just died a few weeks before I got there. When I arrived at university, there was a small shrine set up for him where people would come and pay their respects. And I met the next generation of rats that were being trained up to kind of carry on his good work. The project's expanding all the time. They're not just using rats to detect landmines now. There's a well-advanced project there which is using the same principle for rats to analyze tuberculosis samples. Tuberculosis is a massive killer in Africa. You know, it's millions of people a year die from it. And it's undiagnosed cases in the community is how it spreads. It's a very costly disease for laboratories to sample and test samples through human means. And there are more advanced technological ways of doing it, but that relies on a lot of power in a place where power cuts are quite common and costs a lot of money as well. At Apopo, they've devised a very low-cost solution where they use rats to screen samples for whether they have tuberculosis or not. And it took them a long time to persuade people in the medical community that this was a good idea. You know, the mention of rats to a doctor in terms of benefiting human health is something that's, you know, they would just think is total madness. But actually, the project is now, they have people, laboratories from all over Tanzania that are shipping samples over to university for the rats to detect. The speed they can do it is far, far greater than any human laboratory technician. Same with the accuracy and the cost as well. So it's expanding all the time. There was one other potential for rats saving human lives that they were working on at Apopo, which again was trying to overcome this human prejudice towards rats as well while I was there. And it's training up rats as search and rescue operatives. So in the immediate aftermath of an earthquake or some other form of terrible natural disaster, when rescuers need to search for bodies among the rubble, when they use search and rescue dogs freely. And Apopo, a team there, are working on using rats instead, because obviously rats can are far smaller than dogs, and they possess an incredible ability of fitting through very small tunnels and holes. They can actually physically shrink their skeletons down to fit through tiny holes, you know, really kind of shrinking the bodies to do it. And they were just starting this project when I was there, and they'd set up a few training scenarios of destroyed rooms and buildings that they would release the rats in. I watched a few of them doing it, and they could find bodies in there so quickly. But they were so worried about how a human might react to being rescued by a rat that they gave them all little backpacks with a pre-recorded message on there that when it would arrive, that the human would press a button. It would say, "Hello, I'm a rat and I'm here to save you," which I thought was fantastic.
I love that too. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Joe Shute about rats and how humans think about them fairly and unfairly. His book is Stowaway. So we've been talking about rats from the point of view of how humans relate to them. But when you got your pet rats, Molly and Ermintrude, you wanted to have them help you see rats from their own perspective. So talk a little bit more about that. What did you learn when you watched your rats and kind of got into their mindset?
By the time we got our rats, Molly and Ermintrude, exactly, I was still so sort of afraid of rats that initially my wife had always wanted rats as a kid and was never allowed them. So she was well up for it, and was, as soon as I mentioned it, was like, "Yes, let's go and get some." But I was much more reticent and was genuinely afraid of it. We got them as, you know, they were tiny pups from a rat breeder not far from our house. And I was genuinely afraid of handling them at first. And
they were really cute too.
They're so cute. I mean, I dedicated the book to them for how they opened my eyes to the way rats actually are. I guess the things that they really sort of opened me up to is the bonds that rats form between themselves, but also that they're capable of forming with humans as well. They would react to us in the way that a puppy would react to its human owner when you wake up in the morning or when you come in through the front door. You know, you hear this clang upstairs as the rats would sort of jump around in their cage and waiting to be sort of taken out and played with and stroked. They're incredibly sweet with each other. We ended up getting two more rats, actually. There's in the UK, have you heard of Crofts before? The sort of UK dog show?
No, I hadn't, but yeah, I know about, I mean, we have a dog show here too, so yeah.
Okay, so yeah, they have, in the UK, we have a long tradition of dog shows. I'm sure you do in the US. And I found out writing the book that there's also a subculture of rat shows that goes back to more than 100 years, back to the late Victorian era, when people like Beatrix Potter were keeping pet rats. The sort of quite wealthy middle and upper classes, there was a real fashion for it for a while. And when Molly and Ermintrude were starting to get on a bit, we visited one of these shows because we thought we needed to expand our colony so we wouldn't end up leaving one of the rats on their own. And we met a breeder there, and she gave us two more rats for free. She said, "Just take them." And they were Rita and Agatha. And we introduced them, these two rats, to Molly and Ermintrude's cage. We were quite worried about how they would react to it. And with other animals, we keep chickens as well, for example. And when you introduce new chickens to an established group of them, then it is always kind of blood and feathers and pecking and squawking and all sorts of stuff. We followed the breeder's instruction of how we should introduce the two new rats and did it and went to bed and kind of woke up very sort of hesitant of what it would look like, and found them all just sleeping in this big pile together. And straight away they assimilated them into their colony, and that sort of softness was there as well. I think perhaps the thing that blew my mind the most with them was, and I'd read about it in studies of rats, but that rats grieve for one another. We saw it when Molly died. She was the first rat to die. The great sadness of keeping rats as pets, and you'll know this yourself if you looked after one, is that you form an incredible bond with them and they don't last more than 3 years maximum. So it's quite a lot of heartache keeping rats as pets as well, as a sort of word of caution to anyone thinking to do it. You should do, because they're absolutely wonderful animals. They're great with children, but it is quite painful when they die. And anyway, Molly was the first to die, and we found Ermentrude, her sister, caring for her in her final days, giving her little scraps of food and taking it up to where she was lying. And when she was finally dead, we found one of the rats, we presume was Ermentrude, had pulled a scrap of cloth as a sort of blanket over her and was lying next to her when she was dead, and lay there until we took the body out of the cage. And it's that sort of emotional attachment. And then when you compare that to the things that humans say about rats, you know, and we say like fighting like rats in a sack and ratting someone out, and the idea that a rat is a universally negative thing, devoid of any emotion and simply sort of kind of out for themselves. And it shows how wrong we have rats as creatures.
And finally, Ermentrude was your heart rat. And I could so relate. I mean, I have a heart cat, you know. I have a cat who, of all the cats I've ever had, is really the special one. So talk about your feelings about Ermentrude and why.
So that was a phrase that was told to me by a breeder at one of the rat shows that we visited. And she said no matter how many rats she looked after, she always had this one heart rat that stuck in her mind. She said every rat owner has it. And for me, Ermentrude, it was firstly her sort of beauty. She was a lovely pale champagne kind of coloured variegated fur. She was the boss between, there's always a dominant rat when you have a group of them, and she was the most dominant. So she was, while Molly was more sort of adventurous and a bit more kind of carefree, Ermentrude would be a bit more sort of hesitant, but you know, sort of, I guess, a bit more fierce, but in quite a cool way that I admired. And one of her favourite things, I can never confirm whether this is true or not, but I mentioned rats liking to dance earlier on. And whenever we would hoover around the cage, Ermentrude would always, whether it was day or night, because rats generally sleep in the day and they're awake at night, she'd spring out from wherever she was sleeping and would just chase the sound of the hoover around the cage as you walked around it. And I always just thought that was so fantastic. And I wondered whether the sort of rhythms, the deep throb of the hoover, somehow was something that she was reacting to. But she was, yeah, she was a beauty of a rat, Ermentrude.
You think you'll keep on having rats?
So I mentioned that we went and got the two new ones because all the advice is never to leave a rat by themselves. But we currently do have a rat living by herself, who is Rita, the sole survivor of our colony, which started over the course of writing this book. She is very near the end of life now. And we're expecting, like, any day now, to be honest, that she's going to die. She's got to a very ripe old age for a rat and is beginning to slow down. The reason we haven't introduced any new ones yet is that we're planning on getting boy rats next, because so far we've only had girl rats and have heard from breeders that boy rats are an entirely different proposition. So, yeah, I think our colony is going to live on for future generations for sure.
Well, Joshu, your book Stowaway is just such a wonderful contribution, I think, to what I more and more feel is an imperative, and that is that human beings recognize the animals with whom, the other animals with whom we share this world. And I think you do a beautiful job in this book. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. That's lovely to hear that response to it. And that's certainly my intention of writing the book as well. This idea of just seeing humans as the sole species with dominion over the world is something that seems totally outdated and entirely the wrong way for us to sort of re-engage with the natural world and sort of create a better future for ourselves, really. So I'm delighted to see that that's what you thought of it. So thank you for having me on.
Joe Shute writes about the natural world, including features for the UK newspaper The Daily Telegraph, and is its long-standing Saturday Weather Watch columnist. Stowaway, The Disreputable Exploits of the Rat, is out from Bloomsbury Press. Next up, we explore the world of animal intelligence with Brandon Keim. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to find more great content, including web-only features like interview transcripts and extended interviews. In our first segment today, we talked about one of our animal neighbors, the rat. Now we move to considering all of the other animals as our neighbors. Brandon Keim's book, Meet the Neighbors, explores the emerging science of animal intelligence, what personhood is and how it extends to our animal neighbors, and our complex relationships with the non-human creatures with whom we share the planet. How can better understanding animal minds reshape our relationships with them and perhaps create a future that better serves all the creatures on Earth, including us? Brandon Keim, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca. It's great to be here.
I loved this book, Meet the Neighbors. You know, I actually want to start this conversation with having you tell us a story with which you begin this book, and that is about Fiona Presley's bumblebee, because I went and I went to YouTube and I found the video about it, and it is just so wonderful. Let's start there.
She is a delight. So Fiona Presley is a librarian who lives in Scotland. And a few years ago, she was working in her garden and she found a wet, bedraggled bee. And the bee had no wings. So Fiona took the bee inside and gave her a little bit of sugar water. And I say her because the bee was a queen. And then put her back where she found her and went to work. And then when she came back home, the bee is still where she had put her. And, you know, Fiona's heart just went out to this poor little wingless creature. And so she took her inside and built a little enclosure for her. And she adopted the bee, whom she named Bee. And eventually, as the weather got nicer, she moved the enclosure outside. So over the course of the summer, which was the twilight of the bee's life, Bee the bee was Fiona's companion, and she would hold the bee in the palm of her hand, and Bee would actually fall asleep there. And sometimes Bee was potty trained, and if she needed to relieve herself, she would move over to the edge of Fiona's hand and do her business off the side, because of course bees are clean and fastidious in their own day-to-day lives. And, you know, to hear Fiona tell the story, she truly believed that Bee recognized her, you know, that they really had a relationship. And so, you know, the things I've been describing, if Bee was the size of a dog, or if Bee was a dog, then of course, you know, we would recognize that connection that formed between them. But to think of a person, you know, having a relationship with a bee, and a bee recognizing a human being, that can seem very difficult to believe, but there is actually good science that makes this plausible.
And what is that good science that makes it plausible that Bee was not only a bee, but a friend?
But a friend. Bees have the cognition necessary to recognize individuals. They have emotions. And she actually consulted with a bee cognition expert named Lars Chitka, who supported this. There's good reason to think that Bee did, in fact, recognize Fiona, and that, you know, they did share a connection and a mutual affection. It wasn't just a one-way thing. So, you know, the reason why I love that story, I had first encountered it in a video that was produced by a website called The Dodo. And the number of times this video has been seen is just incredible. You know, it's like one out of every 20 people on Earth or something like that, you know, should have seen this video at this point. I'm not sure exactly if 1/20th is the right fraction, you know, but we are talking, you know, many tens of millions of views. And the reason that the story resonated with me, and I think, you know, the reason that it resonated with so many people, is both because of the incredible evolutionary distance that was crossed by this connection and crossed by this friendship. And also that Fiona, I think, is somebody that it's very easy to see oneself in her, because she is just a kind-hearted person who loves nature and has a sense of other animals as being someone. And, you know, she's not a dyed-in-the-wool environmentalist or an animal rights advocate. She's just kind of a warm-hearted person who loves the living world and is trying to sort of figure out her own place in it. And she just happened across this bee and formed a deep connection with her. And is, yeah, it was just a beautiful story.
And figuring out our own place in relationship to a living world, that really is, you say, a central question of our time. How might an awareness of animal minds, as you write, shape the ways we understand them and ultimately how we live with them on this shared precious planet? Why is that a central question of our time?
One of the arguments that I make in the book is that, you know, when it comes to relating to nature and sort of thinking about the wild world, all these ways that we have of seeing nature, you know, as a source of beauty or transcendence or natural resources, looking at it through the frames of conservation biology and thinking about biodiversity, you know, all of these lenses for looking at nature really don't include a sense of wild animals, or of animals, broadly speaking, don't include a sense of animals as being intelligent, as possessing minds, much like we do. And so I think just sort of both as a matter of principle, let's say if, you know, if we had a theory of economics where the economists just did not engage at all with the idea that the human beings they're describing are people with wants and needs and meaningful societies and thoughts and feelings, we would laugh it out of the room, right? We just wouldn't take it seriously because it would just be missing something so fundamental. So I think that's part of why that is a central question. And I think also, I'm sure your listeners will be very familiar with the fact that we're now undergoing what is, you know, often called the sixth great extinction. And this idea of the Anthropocene, the idea that, you know, this is really the possibly a geologic age, or at least sort of an epoch in principle, in which human activity and human influence is ubiquitous. And it's not that no wildness exists on Earth anymore, but the human influence is everywhere. And the question is, you know, what sort of impacts are we going to have on the life around us? And those impacts are something to understand, not just in terms of biodiversity or population shifting, our impacts on fellow persons who happen not to be human. And the sheer scale at which humanity now exists really makes the way that we think about our relations to other creatures and the connections we have to them and the obligations we have to them, you know, it makes that just really fundamentally defining of the conditions of life on Earth. And I write in the book that it's not only human activity in the sense of road building and building cities and agriculture and physical activity that is now written on the face of the Earth, but it's also our values.
Say more about that, our values.
That is one of those incredibly simple yet deceptively complex questions. How we think about other beings, how we think about ourselves for that matter, and how we treat one another, but how we think about other animals shapes the way we relate to them and we relate to nature. And, you know, in that sense, those, you know, those values are going to be inscribed in the world in the sense that they dictate the choices that we make, the places that we build, the way that we build, who we choose to protect, who we choose to relate to. And I think, you know, in the future, it's very possible to imagine a world in which a great deal of biodiversity is lost, that, you know, there are many species extinctions, that is ecological upheaval and collapse. But even if that still happens, there is going to be so much life in this world, so much wildlife, and we'll still have the question of, well, how do we relate to it? How do we think about these creatures? And where do you live, Francesca?
I live on Eastern Long Island.
So I've spent a little bit of time in Eastern Long Island, and I think it actually has a lot in common with suburban Bethesda, Maryland, where the first part of the book is set, and which was kind of the soil out of which a lot of this sensibility sprung, where, you know, Bethesda is a densely populated human place. You know, the suburbs are just an endless sprawl. And at first glance, you know, when I moved there, you know, it was really the humanity that I saw. And I came to appreciate just how much wildlife there was, you know, how verdant it was. You know, I'd walk out my door and there's animals all over the place, and they're not the sort of animals, you know, maybe you pay much attention to if you're really focused on rarity or uniqueness, or but there's sparrows and pigeons and rabbits and deer and Canada geese in the stormwater pond, and so much life living with and around us. And when I visited Long Island, it's been the same way. You know, the question is, okay, well, you know, this isn't, is biodiversity the right lens through which to view our relations to those creatures? I think it is certainly conservation. Conservation biology is an important lens, and I'm not saying we shouldn't think about the creatures around us that way, but there's also just this sense of these animals as truly being neighbors and sharing an environment with them. And that's an insight that I think is very easy to appreciate in suburbs, but the implications are not limited to suburbs. You know, that sensibility really is relevant to the whole face of this human-covered earth at this point.
And neighbor, you know, we talked about values. The value of neighborliness, I think, is really a central one. You know, that you look out for each other, that you care about your neighbors. I mean, it brings to mind the time when I no longer do this, pretty much for this reason, but I was blowing leaves off my backyard, and all of a sudden I saw a box turtle that emerged from the leaves that I was blowing, and I immediately stopped. Luckily, it was not a gas leaf blower, but even so, it was quite a disturbance for the creature. And so I stopped immediately, and I just went on and did other things. And the next day, I was in my backyard with a friend, and all of a sudden, who comes up to us and just settles right between us as my friend and I were, you know, just conversing with each other, and looks up at us but this box turtle. And I really felt, I mean, I just knew that box turtle was saying hi and thank you and acknowledging that we were neighbors, in fact, and maybe even thanking me for understanding that.
I love that story.
That was part of my coming to an understanding of the other animals with whom we share this planet, our neighbors, our persons. You mentioned person before. Let's talk about animals as persons. What makes a person? And how has the science of animal intelligence informed our evolving understanding of what personhood is?
So again, I love the story of that turtle. And of course, you know, that box turtle was not just a unit of a species or a box turtle who could have just been exchanged with another box turtle and everything remains the same. You know, that box turtle was an individual with a personal story and self-awareness and a life of his or her own in that world. And, you know, so that box turtle was a person. And so it was the philosopher Immanuel Kant who had defined a person as being intrinsically valuable and not a means to someone else's end. And, you know, I think that's kind of part of our working everyday definition of what a person is. A person is a someone, not a something. In the science of animal intelligence, really in the last several decades, has just flourished, and it has described the cognitive underpinnings of personhood in humans. So self-awareness is the big one, but then also emotions, remembering the past, thinking of the future, having meaningful social relationships, you know, sort of all of these capacities that go into our sense of ourselves as persons have also been described in other animals. And originally that was concentrated within other great apes, cetaceans, later on corvids, the species who were very quick to recognize as being extremely intelligent. But one of the big shifts in the last 10 or 15 years has been the description of these capacities, not only in those, you know, extremely intelligent creatures, but really throughout the animal kingdom. You know, and I'm not saying here that the box turtle was just a little human in a turtle suit or something like that. Not at all. But if you were put in the head of that turtle, their experience would be something that you could relate to. And, you know, and I think for me that the single biggest, I think, scientific development in how we understand personhood has come also as much from the philosophers as from the scientists. And it's this idea of self-awareness as being, you know, not only the sort of very self-reflective forms of self-awareness that humans are best known for, where we really think about ourselves in the third person and spend a lot of time reflecting upon ourselves. But it just comes down to this, you know, much more fundamental, basic awareness that you are you and that you are embodied and distinct from the world. And I can talk a bit about some of the science of that if you like, but that's the essential message, that there is self-awareness is distributed throughout the animal kingdom.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. My guest is Brandon Keim, and we're talking with him about his book, Meet the Neighbors, Animal Minds and Life in a More Than Human World. Yeah, and maybe just briefly, because you know, there's so much in this book, I'd like to touch on some of the other things you talk about and some of the stories that you tell. But yeah, just briefly, give us the science of animal intelligence that has deepened our understanding of the other creatures as being persons.
Yeah, so first of all, self-awareness. Historically, the gold standard of measuring self-awareness has been something called the mirror self-recognition test. And so the idea is that if an animal will use a mirror to inspect a mark that has been made on some part of their body that they can't otherwise see, then we'll say they're self-aware. So, you know, a scientist will sneak up on a chimpanzee while she's asleep and, you know, maybe dab a little bit of paint in the back of her head. And then later on, if the chimpanzee uses a mirror and sees, oh, wait a second, on the back of my head, there's this paint mark that I don't know about. Why should there be a paint mark on the back of my head? And then, you know, the chimpanzee investigates that mark that she's seen in the mirror, then that is considered to be indicative of the chimpanzee having a sense of self. And, you know, there's a handful of species who pass this test, you know, certain other great apes, manta rays, dolphins, maybe cleaner wrasse fish. But in any ways, it's pretty few and far between. But that test has also been criticized sort of on two grounds. The first is that it really just overemphasizes sight. So, you know, us humans being such a visually oriented species, then our sense of self is very much mediated by how we, even the idea of reflecting upon ourselves, you know, our mental self image, all of these things, you know, these are very sight forward frameworks. But some scientists say, well, wait a second, you know, maybe for other species who are not so dependent on sight as we are, and instead depend more on other senses, their sense of self will instead be sort of wrapped up in that. And there's been really interesting work done sort of developing, you know, olfactory versions of the mirror test, where instead of testing whether an animal recognizes themselves in a mirror, you're testing whether they recognize their own scent. And so dogs pass that, and this has been done with other species, and it kind of opens the door for, oh, wait a second, actually, maybe there's much more reflective self-awareness going on, and you just have to find other ways of looking at it. But then there's yet another critique, which is saying, wait a second, this particular form of self-awareness we're looking at, you know, reflective self-awareness, this is this extremely specialized thing, but it's just one point on a spectrum of self-awareness. And there's something much more fundamental going on as well, pre-reflective self-awareness, bodily self-awareness. And the experiment that I love on of this was done with rat snakes. And so rat snakes, you know, so of course they're snakes, they eat rats. You can have in your mind's eye this picture of, you know, a snake who's just eaten a rat and has a big ball in the middle of their belly, in the middle of their body. And so the researchers developed this methodology where basically you have a wrapped snake who crosses an enclosure, and in doing so, they have to go through a board that has two holes in it, you know, one small hole and one big hole. Now, before a rat snake eats, they'll go through the small hole because, of course, their body is going to fit through that. But after they eat, when they're going across the enclosure, they'll use the big hole because, of course, you know, now they've got this big ball in the center of their body, they're going to need the big hole. But what that shows you is that the rat snake has an awareness of its own body and its own shape. And on the one hand, that, you know, that's the kind of thing, like, it's incredibly self-evident. Why would that not be the case? But the great insight there that really is coming from the philosophers who are thinking about this is to understand that as a form of self-awareness, not one that's all wrapped up in thinking about the past and looking into the future, but just understanding oneself in the world. And that sense of self-awareness is just so fundamental to our own self-conception. It's, I think, you know, it is truly impossible to imagine oneself without a sense of self. So for me, that's really the most powerful scientific development. But in addition to that, you know, there have also just been so much research describing capacities that are very important to us. So emotion, of course, it's almost as difficult to imagine a life without any sorts of feelings as it is to imagine not having a sense of self. And we now appreciate that emotion is just found throughout the animal kingdom. And some of the most beautiful studies on that have been done, appropriately enough, with bees and with bumblebees, you know, showing that they too are capable of feeling good or feeling bad, feeling happy or feeling sad. And, you know, and I just love the bumblebee studies because it just suggests that the world around us is teeming with feelings. And then also, I think the sort of the third thing that is so central to who we are as persons is the relationships we have with others. And there's just more and more research, you know, so we all know, of course, that, you know, many animals live in social groups, that they have these connections. But I think there's really been a much more research describing social relationships in species who we don't usually think of as being social, like river turtles and garter snakes and what have you, but also appreciating that these relationships are experienced in the first person, and that, you know, animals truly have emotional connections and bonds to each other, and that these relationships are meaningful to them.
And they have a kind of society, too. This is something I totally did not know, that animals vote. You have whooper swans that vote by honking. And in fact, you say, I mean, I think just like emotions, there is compelling evolutionary reasons for animals to have feelings, and obviously they would have had to have feelings hundreds of millions of years ago in evolution to get to us today that have them. But you say there's a good evolutionary reason for democracy. So tell us about animals voting, what that says about animal society and evolution.
So it's very, very appropriate to the moment, of course. So the evolutionary explanation for why democracy can be successful is that basically you're combining, you're bringing in as much information as you can. You know, every individual has things that they know, brings their own knowledge to bear, and democracy, you could say, is a way of pooling that. And also, you know, depending on how it's done, a way of coming to some sort of group consensus in a way that at least allows everyone's interest to be expressed and hopefully reduces the amount of conflict that happens between them. But my favorite study of this actually came from a whale biologist named Hal Whitehead. And he had been sort of looking at the movement patterns of sperm whales, and he recognized in those patterns the spatial signature of democracy. So the way that the whales moved, you know, each going his or her own way, and then eventually coalescing upon some more orderly direction, that actually turns out to be almost the movement signature of democracy. And it's kind of what you get, you know, when as animals are negotiating where they want to go as a collective and then finally make that decision and go that way. And, you know, you mentioned the whooping swans, of course. African wild dogs are another species who've had some fame for being democratic, where it seems they vote by sneezing on where they want to go as a group. And if you just Google animal democracy and sort of, you know, look in the Google Scholar results, you'll find so many descriptions of of democratic decision-making systems in animals. And so, of course, you don't have to have democracy to have a society, of course. But I think that part of what is so powerful about the idea of animals having democracy is that it really makes their societies that much more relatable to ours. And, you know, it's thinking of animals having society. It's such a subtle little shift, and yet it's so profound. Society is something that, of course, human beings have, and we don't tend to think of other animals having that. You know, and I think speaking for myself, and I wasn't even aware that I didn't think of other animals having that until I read scholars who were talking about other animals as having societies and sort of putting these scientific findings into that language. And then it was like a light goes off where it's like, oh my goodness, you know, it's, yeah, we can think of other animals as having society. And that is, I think, such a profound grounds for kinship.
Brandon Keim is an independent journalist specializing in animals, nature, and science. His work appears regularly in the New York Times, The Atlantic, Nautilus, National Geographic, and elsewhere. He lives in Bangor, Maine. That's all the time we have on this broadcast, but you can subscribe to our Writer's Voice podcast to hear the rest of their conversation, where Keim tells us about new developments in the movement for animal rights. You can get Writer's Voice anywhere you get your podcasts. You can also go to writersvoice.net to hear the full interview, read the transcript, and get links to more resources. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. Stay connected with Writer's Voice. Find us on YouTube, Facebook, X, and Instagram. Just search on Writer's Voice. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.